Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Christopher Gregory, attorney registration numbers 37095. I represent the plaintiff appellants in this case, John and Mary Lou Gregory, and if it may please the court. This case presents a stark contrast and a stark choice. On one hand, this court can accept a pro forma analysis, or on the other hand, it can delve deeper and look at the actual expectations and consequences involved in the dispute before.
We don't have to look at expectations, though. Don't we just need to look at the claims and determine whether or not the claims were within the contemplation that's expressed in the contract?
Your Honor, I think we need to look at the fundamental facts that come up through the underlying case, which do relate to those claims. But we also must look at the general context in which we have defined the duty to defend. With that said, I think that the choice is pretty clear. I think Justice Louis Brandeis summarized the correct view, which is where the logic of words conflicts with the logic of reality, the logic of words must yield to the logic of reality. Here, there are three basic facts that the court, or anyone looking at this case, really should address in a direct way. The first being, we have multiple documents of record that were not accepted from the underlying insurance policy. Each one of these documents of record had some sort of impact upon what was actually insured through that policy. A way of looking at, I guess, the title insurance policy a little differently than another form of insurance.
Counsel, before you go on to that, sure. As to these multiple documents of record that you referenced, were any of them mentioned in the neighbor's counterclaims in the quiet title action?
Not directly, but that is sort of the point of applying interpretive rules. It's also the point of why I believe it's necessary to look at the entire public record here. We have a title insurance policy. Its entire function is to protect against defects on title. A lot of the exceptions that have been raised by the appellees in this case have to do with things being not of public record. Well, it's not fair to allow someone to say, well, we had no duty to defend here because in the claims themselves, nobody identified a specific document. They were implicated. And
how can a prescriptive easement, as an example, be implicated in a title insurance policy?
Well, the point that was brought up in the brief, which I think is a good one, we have a 18-year statute of limitation on adverse possession, similarly relating to prescription. And that had not expired at the time that the underlying action was filed. So really, when you had the owners that were in dispute here had a common predecessor and interest. The only way that they could recover from the other side of this case is some sort of color of title theory, where they acquire their rights through someone else.
Well, even if we assume that's true, counsel, did they assert such a title theory in their counterclaims?
But they don't have to. We're dealing with a notice pleading standard here. And the contrast, it is in the treaties that I cited, kind of comparing things to Oregon. If we were in a co-pleading state like Oregon, there would be an obligation for plaintiff, cross-claimant, anyone bringing one of these actions, to state everything they wanted as far as ultimate facts. And there would be a penalty if failing to state those things adversely impacted the opposing side in the future. Here, they didn't bring their theory up until later when they were putting forth a designation of their expert witnesses, until we got into the summary judgment stages of things. But that is natural, and it's what normally happens when you do have a notice pleading standard. Well, nothing prevented them from bringing that up.
Excuse me for interrupting, Mr. Gregory, but if we're to adopt your view of this case, won't that require us to read something other than the plain language of the insurance policy?
No, and actually this is the biggest point. And I think, well, the TCD case was cited that Judge Richmond authored. And it's cited for the proposition that we can only look at just the counterclaims. And we can only, you know, look at the document itself. Well, I think that the court needs to sort of view this differently. It needs to look at it more as a concept than a physical dimension. If you have pleadings, if you have a contract, it is possible to incorporate just about anything by reference. And when you do that incorporation, it becomes part of the context and actually part of the document itself. I'm not asking that we open up to new standards.
But they did not incorporate by reference anything in the counterclaims here, did they?
They did when it comes to use of this term access road. That they were actually responding to what was averred in the complaint itself. Only they used a different definition, which created the ambiguity, which created, you know, essentially the argument that I'm making that this, you know, would be readily capable of different means. And again, I think when we're dealing with a duty to defend situation, it really is their burden to establish that we don't have the possibility of multiple meanings. And it's completely unfair to allow an insurance company to create its own definitions of words and things that are divorced from their real context. What was incorporated by reference, you know, may not specifically have been other than references to like the 1994 notice that the federal government issued saying essentially that the other insured in this case could not expand the roadway in the way that they were filing the underlying action for. There was that reference in there. But if you look at the complaint, there's cross-referencing. But more importantly, if you look at the actual title insurance policy, it is full of cross-referencing. The only exception that related to the underlying co-defendants, the McCulloughs, was exception 17. And all it did was say, we will not be covering what's in this 1994 notice. The 1994 notice specifically said they were restricted to essentially a historic driveway that was less than 30 feet in width because the other documents, including the survey that was incorporated by reference in the policy, showed that they couldn't physically expand that, that they couldn't change the use from a single family residence used for agricultural purposes to anything else. Notice specifically forbade the McCulloughs from subdividing their property, from opening the road up to public use, and yet all of these things became the substance of the underlying action. If the insurance company said, you know, we won't defend that, if all we're doing is strictly interpreting, you know, that exception and strictly construing it against the insurer, well, then all of these other claims and the reliance upon whatever other source they had was beyond the scope of that exception and did create a possibility of coverage. But, you know, the critical distinction here, the Nutmeg case was cited in the TCD. I'm not asking for that. What I'm saying is, instead of, you know, having alternative facts or whatever else you might incorporated in one of these examinations at the federal court, that we're not engaging in any fact-finding at all. All we're looking at are documents, things that can be interpreted as a matter of law. That would be the policy. That would be the pleadings as they relate to themselves. The critical question is, under any circumstances, would the insurer be obligated to do something on behalf of its insurer?
Counsel,
would it have an indemnification obligation?
Sorry, I apologize for interrupting.
No, please do.
It seems like what you're asking us to do is precisely what the Court of Appeals did in the Compass case. And the Supreme Court said we were wrong to do that, that we were wrong to look beyond the actual complaint and to look to other parts of the case which might have informed the insurer's duty to defend. So how can we follow your guidance here, or follow your suggestion here, without running afoul of the Supreme Court's opinion in Compass?
Right, and actually, I think the Supreme Court's opinion in Compass is the binding thing here. But they're not facts. Think of it as if, you know, looking at all of these things, that they're either part of the complaint, part of the pleading that's at issue that would create the obligation for coverage, or they're part of the policy. It's the incorporation by reference. It's the fact that any number of these things could relate directly back to what was actually insured. If you look at the indemnification clause and its exact wording, saying that the insurance company is obligated to defend defects against title, including encumbrances, including liens, including things that you would expect in the public record. And then you look at the separate clause, which is very unique in a title insurance policy, to the duty to defend, which states the company will also pay the costs, attorney's fees, and expenses incurred in the defense of title as insured, but only to the extent provided by conditions and stipulations. That is an independent obligation of the insurer to provide a benefit. The expectation here, and again, this is why I think it's so important to step away from formalism and look at the actual function of what's going on. The expectation is you buy a title insurance policy. If there's a problem with it, particularly if it relates to the public record, which the insurer has an obligation to conduct a reasonable examination of, then your expectation is that you're not going to pay a single cent for attorney's fees, costs, or any expenses that relate to defending the title that they actually insured.
But counsel, wouldn't a reasonable person's expectations be informed by the exclusions in the policy? Because all of the duties that the insurer has are subject to the exclusions. So if the claims asserted against the insured come within the exclusion, then the insured would have no reasonable expectation to think the insurer is going to defend.
Right, but the exclusions do not encompass what's at issue here. The exclusions that were asserted by Fidelity in this case all relate to things that are not of public record. That would be the complete extent of them. And the fact that there could be a legal theory that would implicate a public record, whether they state that public record or not in their pleadings, isn't the determinative thing. It's the possibility that that existed.
But didn't the counterclaims exclude the possibility that the counterclaims are based on public records?
No, they don't. There is no formal disclaimer in the pleadings themselves. At no point in those pleadings does the McCulloughs or Ty Schrock and Lassard, who's Fidelity's president counsel representative, nowhere in there do they say, we write these claims completely in the absence of anything in the public record that would support them. If you had that kind of explicit disclaimer, we'd have a different case. But the possibility still existed.
I thought it was your position that for example, the 1994 filing by the government was contrary to their claims. Isn't that your position?
That is.
Okay. So why in the world would they cite to the 1994 document if it was contrary to their claims? They're saying they have an easement notwithstanding that document. It's your defenses, maybe, that document, but that's not their claim.
Well, no, and that's exactly it. That if it was just limited to the 1994 notice, then there would be no coverage. But they were asking for things that are greater than that, and in so doing, they were implicating...
Doesn't that by definition mean what they're asking for is not a public record?
No, it just means it's not the 1994 notice.
What public record was that it related to?
Related to the 1963 deed from the U.S. government to Montrose County that describes a public roadway, not in its actual physical place, but crossing onto the Gregory property. It related to a 1914
deed. Okay, so let me stop you there. Do they say in their counterclaim, this claim arises under the 1963 deed, or we incorporate by reference the 1963 deed? No.
No, but the policy itself incorporates the entire public record up to 1996, saying that we're insuring against defects in that. If I could file a demand for a defense by just bringing up one of these documents, absent litigation, and there would be a duty to defend, then there should still be a duty to defend if those defects exist, and all we have are generic pleadings. If I could reserve, I guess, the last 20 seconds here for rebuttal.
Okay, Mr. Gregory.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Christian Aguilar, registration number 38146, and I represent Fidelity National Title Insurance Company and Fidelity National Financial. Now, Your Honors, the trial court correctly found that Fidelity National Title Insurance Company had no duty to defend the Gregorys against the counterclaims asserted against them in the underlying action in Montrose County District Court, which the Gregorys brought against their neighbors seeking to bar the use of an access road. And the court arrived at this finding by applying the complaint rule, also known as the Four Corners Rule. And under this rule, a duty to defend arises where an allegation or allegations in the complaint, if sustained, would impose a liability that would be covered by the insurance policy. But where the allegations are solely and entirely within the exceptions of the policy, there is no duty to defend. So the complaint rule, or Four Corners Rule, requires a comparison of the allegations with the policy, including its exceptions. And as the mentioned earlier, the TCD case issued by this court last year, TCD versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company, confirmed that the complaint rule applies equally to a case like this one, involving not a complaint per se, but rather the counterclaims, and confirmed in that case that the analysis for purposes of the duty to defend is restricted to the allegations, in this case of the counterclaims, and the exceptions. Now, the counterclaims in this case were all based on the same theory, that the neighbors, Gregory's neighbors, had a right to use an existing access road, and not based on any deed or recorded document, but based on use, possession, or necessity. And that applies to all of the counterclaims, including prescriptive easement, implied easement by necessity and by prior use, adverse possession, claims that the access road is a public road open to their use based on prescription, federal statute, and state statute, as well as a claim for private condemnation.
Counsel, sorry to interrupt. I just want to clarify that I heard you correctly. All the claims, or both of the claims for public road, they depended in part on use by prescription or adverse use. Is that correct?
There were actually, Your Honor, three separate claims that the access road would be, it was open for use as a public road. One based on prescriptive use. The second was based on federal statute, Title 42 of the U.S. Code. But in that claim, the neighbors specifically state that all that was required under the federal statute is actual use of the road, and that's all they allege is actual use of the road, not any kind of deeded access. And then the other claim under the public road is under the state statute, CRS 43-201. And again, the allegations there were restricted to the historical use of the road rather than any kind of public deed or dedication of the road.
Thank you.
And we're actually dealing, in this case, the coverage issues revolve around three different exceptions that I just wanted to clarify. First, an exception in the policy for rights or claims of possession not shown by the public record. Second, easements or claims of easements, again, not shown by the public record. And third, an exception for rights of way for existing roads. Now, all of the counterclaims were solely, first of all, solely and entirely within the exception for existing roads. All of the counterclaims uniformly refer to the access road as an existing visible physical road. They refer to it as the road in question. The counterclaimants claim that their use of that road is open, notorious, and visible. They allege that the road itself is a permanent and substantial improvement, plainly visible, and that it's been historically used. And so the counterclaims were, first of all, solely and entirely within the existing road exception. Going back and applying the complaint rule, these allegations, if sustained, would give the neighbors a right to use an existing road, which falls under that exception. Yes, Your Honor.
Assuming that the counterclaims were not based on any document of public record, did the Gregorys, in response, let's see, it would be in reply to the counterclaims, assert as affirmative defense that the documents of public record defeat the neighbor's counterclaims? Which is what I think Mr. Gregory said in his argument here.
I would, Your Honor, I would have to review the record again to answer that with full confidence, but I don't think it's relevant to this analysis for the duty to defend, which I think would be restricted to the counterclaims themselves.
That's really where I was getting going. Yeah. Can an affirmative defense to a claim impact upon the duty to defend? Do one of our cases address that? Did I address that in TCD? I don't remember.
I don't believe you did, Your Honor.
Okay.
So I believe you're referring to a defense that would have been raised by the Gregorys in response to the first
such document defeats your claim for an easement. Isn't that an issue that would arise under a document of public record? But it would not necessarily, I agree, be a claim against them.
Without reviewing the record, I'm not sure whether they had done that. But even had they done that, I don't think it would have any relevance to the analysis for duty to defend in this case, because the counterclaims themselves never refer or rely on or allege any kind of right to use the access road based on public record. So on the one hand, we have the existing roads exception. On the other hand, we have the exceptions for claims or rights of possession and claims or rights of easements, again, both not of record.
Counsel, before you move on to that exception and moving back to the existing roads exception, what is your response to Mr. Gregory's argument that the term access road was ambiguous and perhaps incorporated by reference some documents?
Your Honor, I think in reviewing the counterclaims themselves, it's clear that there is no ambiguity, as the trial court found. The counterclaimants are, there's no question they're referring to an existing road that they need to use to access their property. And it's, going back to the language within those counterclaims themselves, that it's a permanent substantial improvement, plainly visible. There are no allegations in those counterclaims that they're referring to a road on paper or something that is not physical or not visible. And as this court found in the Carl's Italian Restaurant versus Truck Insurance Exchange case back in 2007, in doing the analysis for a duty to defend, and the court can't read hypothetical facts into the allegations. And respectfully, I think that's what's being urged here by the Gregorys. I think it's clear that in this case, in the allegations are referring to an existing road, as the trial court found.
And just to sort of help you transition to the point you were going to make about the public records exception, doesn't that exception cover the situation regardless of whether we apply the exception for existing roads?
I think the exception, they both apply, I guess, is the point I would make, is, and I tried to make in the brief as well, is that the existing road exception applies on the one hand. On the other hand, the standard exceptions for claims or rights of possession or easement not of record also apply in this case. And I would like to respond also to Mr. Gregory's argument. It's along the same lines with regards to the adverse possession claim, because that would be the one claim that would fall under the exception for rights or claims of possession not shown of record. And the argument is that this must have been a color of title claim because they were not there for 18 years. Well, a color of title claim requires some kind of allegation that a party has a right to property based on an ineffective instrument of some kind. And there's no allegation whatsoever in the counterclaims of a right to the access road by either effective or an ineffective instrument. So that color of title, including the color of title statute, requires payment of taxes on the property for 7 years. There were no allegations to that effect either.
Indeed, their allegations are that the road was used through some theory of implied easement, prescription, actual use.
Yes, Your Honor. So for
going through the claims for in the one hand for with the along with you were mentioning, Your Honor, prescriptive easement, implied easements, a public road, and a right of condemnation to use the access. All of those claims are based on either necessity or use or possession, necessity or use in those cases, and therefore would fall under the standard exception that was part of the Gregory's policy for easements or claims of easements, not of record. And that then leaves the claim for adverse possession, which I was just addressing, which falls under the exception for claims or rights of possession, not of record. And courts in other jurisdictions, as we pointed out in our briefs, have consistently found that these standard exceptions that we're talking about now, that for either rights or claims of possession or easements not of record, cover the kind of claims that are being made in the counterclaims here, including prescriptive easement, public road, and implied easement, fall under those standard exceptions for claims or rights of possession or easement not of record. And that those has been consistently applied around the country by other courts with respect to these standard exceptions. The affirmative defenses, as the trial court found, the affirmative defenses raised by the counterclaimants, those are not part of the analysis for the duty to defend, in part because they're not allegations. The affirmative defenses in this case were in response to the allegations by the Gregory's that the neighbors could not use the access road.
But following up on that,
give rise to I'm sorry,
just following up on your what your discussion of those affirmative defenses asserted by the counterclaimants. If any of those affirmative defenses had imposed liability on the Gregory's, if accepted by the fact finder, wouldn't the insurer have a duty to defend against those affirmative defenses, to use an odd phrase?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Well, first of all, I'm having trouble imagining how an affirmative defense could have imposed a liability on the Gregory's, in that the affirmative defenses were raised in response to the Gregory's own claims in this case. So the affirmative defenses could have had if sustained, would have the effect of thwarting the Gregory's claims.
But it would have afforded no, if sustained, they would have afforded no particular relief to the counterclaimants other than escape from liability imposed upon them by the Gregory's claims?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the trial court, in looking at that issue, also found that even if the court had looked at those, they did not see how they could have imposed liability. In the short time I have left, I'd just like to address a few of the other arguments raised by the Gregory's, one of which is that the trial court erred by applying an incorrect standard for summary judgment. I think in their brief, the Gregory's are conflating and confusing the standard for duty to defend as articulated in Hecla Mining with the summary judgment standard. And in this case, the trial court correctly first applied the duty to defend analysis, comparing the allegations with the exceptions, and then given that finding, then correctly applied the summary judgment standard. So the court in this case applied both, and I believe in their brief, the Gregory's appear to conflate those two. Hecla Mining did not change the standard of Rule 56 or the summary judgment standard. And in this case, the court correctly found, having applied the duty to defend analysis, that Fidelity National Title Insurance was entitled to summary judgment. Your Honors, the trial court correctly applied a complaint rule in this case when it found that Fidelity had no duty to defend the Gregory's against their neighbor's counterclaims. Because the Fidelity was a prevailing party, the award of costs was proper
and should be upheld. Fidelity respectfully requests this court affirms the holding of the trial court.
Thank you, Mr. Agler. Mr. Gregory?
Vagueness doesn't excuse the duty to defend in this case. Also, this isn't an automobile insurance case. It's not money damages or the possibility of money damages that determine the duty to defend. It's the impact on title. And given that, if the court looks at the entire structure and what's trying to be accomplished, I'm confident that you will recognize the need for a duty to defend in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Gregory. Thank you again, Mr. Agler. The matter is deemed submitted, and you can expect a written opinion to issue in due course.